Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Janae Cummings.
And I'm Kelly Worley. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, July 20th, 2016.
The act of drowning is not what people typically think. So, you know, we're kind of conditioned to see what we see on TV, this very dramatic event with lots of splashing and yelling for help. But actually, it's actually a very quiet activity.
We talk with local experts about swimming, drowning, and water safety later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we discuss the risks of playing Pokemon Go on a new edition of our consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
The Seven Oaks Classical School has pushed back its opening date to September 6th due to a delay in construction. The first day of class was originally scheduled for August 15th, but construction is not scheduled to end until August 30th. The adjusted first day of school is set for September 6th. Terry English, a Seven Oaks board member and spokesperson, says this delay will likely affect the rest of the academic calendar, but the school will still have the 180-day school year required by the state.
It's a little difficult to tell exactly what's going to happen at this point in time. The bottom line is that we'll have to modify our calendar to make sure that we get the mandatory 180 days in for instruction for our students. So we'll have to modify our calendar in order to be able to accomplish that. So far, we've not gotten any negative feedback from parents who have already enrolled their children. So we believe that we'll be able to accommodate all the students without a problem going forward.
Seven Oaks is a charter school providing students with, quote, classical schooling, unquote. This is its first year of operation. According to the Herald Times, nearby school districts, including the Monroe County Community School Corporation and Richland Bean Blossom Community Schools, have expressed concern that Seven Oaks will take students from their programs and result in a loss of funding. Seven Oaks currently has more than 200 students enrolled, and English says this delay in construction has not resulted in any of those students leaving for other schools. The school will be operating out of Eagles Landing, an elementary school that has been closed since 2002 and is in need of major renovations. Work on the building has not yet started, although electricians and contractors will start demolition on Thursday, and the rest of the construction should start next week. English says the school is doing whatever it can to prevent any more delays.
It's an old school, and we're going to have to repair mechanical portions, plumbing, air conditioning, heating, electric. We'll have to come in and strip the flammable products out of the classrooms and other areas, and generally have to give it some care and upkeep that it hasn't had for almost 15 years now. We're striving to open on time, and the contractors with whom we're dealing have tremendous experience in terms of dealing with charter school renovation, and we trust their timeline. Nothing guarantees that we will open on a pushback date, but we anticipate that we're going to do it in the best of our ability, aren't going to tolerate any further delays.
Seven Oaks may offer academic camps between August 15th and September 6th to provide childcare for the families who are expecting children to be out of the house during those 3 weeks. These camps will not count toward the 180-day school year required by the state, but English says they will serve to help kids prepare for the school year.
Teachers will do academic programs. This is not going to be an extension of summer break. We're actually going to strive to get our students up to speed before we have our first classroom day.
The next board meeting for Seven Oaks will be held on August 2nd at 6:30 p.m. at an undecided location. The meeting will be open to the public.
The Bloomington City Council left for a six-week recess last week without voting on the fate of a proposed electrical substation at the corner of 11th and Rogers Streets. Bloomington residents have expressed concern about Duke Energy's choice of location for the substation, saying the substation would be noisy, unsightly, and bring down area property values. At a meeting last week, Council Member Chris Sturbaum said he has been in conversation with area residents and city staff on a proposal that addresses those concerns.
The simple proposal is, let's screen that substation with a wall that's high enough to block it, which will stop sound and sight pollution. And then let's leave enough land along the street to build structures that were already intended for the tech park, which will further screen and also make that an active corner instead of a simple substation with a chain link fence and gravel.
Sturbaum said it was time to, quote, learn to build urban substations without having a negative effect, unquote. And he cited other cities where urban substations were masked with liner walls and even fronted by commercial space.
And so we're saying to Duke, this doesn't have to be one side loses and one side wins. This is an important location for Duke, and they've made it very clear and made a very good argument for that. And it's an important location for our city. It matters to our neighborhoods right behind and right across the tracks from that substation that would, if unscreened, would be a blight and would hurt property values. And if unscreened, would have a negative effect on our tech park. So what's interesting is they're listening and they're talking. And what they said to us at a meeting with the city, that they needed time. They said, this has to go through, believe me, they said, this has to go through three different departments back in North Carolina, I think they might have said, where their headquarters is. So you don't turn a big ship around very fast. But the fact that they want more time is a great sign that they're considering that this is a possibility.
During public comment, IU economist and Maple Heights resident Joanna Veronikovich said many in the community still don't approve of the site location. Veronikovich also said, according to her research, it's up to local authorities to set limits for public utilities.
Really, there are not many provisions for public utilities in our state, and this means that it's left up to the local municipalities to really put those provisions in place if we wanted any type of setback provisions, et cetera. And so I really just wanted to encourage the City Council and the administration and the Plan Commission to think about what types of provisions are necessary to put in place at the local level that will help prevent these types of issues arising in the future. And
Veronikovich and Near West Side resident Sandra Clothier said they'd both like to hear Mayor John Hamilton's thoughts on the project. Clothier said she expected a progressive mayor to stand up for the people. Veronikovich said the administration, weighing in on the discussion, might expedite a resolution. Bloomington resident Robert Harmon said he didn't want the city to have to pay for masking the substation.
As I have said before, I really dislike the location. I think it should be closer to IU. But that said, you know, I'll leave it there. With respect to what Chris and Mark have, the drawings that they have, I can kind of like it. If that's going to be a compromise, I think I could go with that, you know. The one thing I don't like, though, is the city having to pay for this, if that's an option. I really don't like the city having to, you know, basically make a pig's ear look like a silk purse.
The council voted 8-0 to postpone a vote on the Duke Energy substation proposal. Council member Steve Volin was absent. The council is not scheduled to hold a regular meeting again until August 31st.
Former Herald Times editor Bill Schrader has been selected for induction into the Indiana Journalism Hall of Fame. Schrader worked at the Herald Times, then called the Herald Telephone, from 1966 to 1985, according to a Herald Times article. During his time there, he served as sports editor, managing editor, and editor and associate publisher. Schrader will be inducted into the Hall of Fame on September 17th at a ceremony in Indianapolis. Stephen Moberly, a former member of the Shelbyville House of Representatives from Bloomington, will also be inducted into the Hall of Fame at the ceremony, along with four other Indiana journalists.
The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children says one in five runaways has been the victim of sex trafficking. The president of the Indiana Youth Institute, Tammy Silverman, reports that last year there were 53 cases of child sex trafficking in Indiana. This month, three new laws will bring harsher penalties to offenders. The first expands the definition of sex offenders to include child sex traffickers. A second makes it a felony to maintain and a misdemeanor to visit a common nuisance where trafficking is happening. And a third allows the Department of Child Services to step in to help a child if they or an adult in their home is involved in sex trafficking. Silverman says social media is frequently used to groom and recruit kids, and that Indiana law requires that every adult report suspected child abuse or neglect, including sex trafficking. To do so, observers or victims may call a hotline at 1-800-800-5556 or text HELP to INFO. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Janae Cummings.
And I'm Kelly Worley. Indiana newspapers are riddled with stories involving children and teens drowning in bodies of water from backyard pools to Lake Michigan. The American College of Emergency Physicians cites drowning as the leading cause of unintentional death among children between 1 and 4 years of age. Sarah Vaughn explores swimming, drowning, and water safety with local experts.
I don't remember at what age I learned to swim. It feels to me like I've always known how, and I love it. I love the way the water feels gliding over my arms as I propel myself down the length of a pool, the tingling rush of blood to my brain as I pair my strokes and my breath in a quick rhythm. I love the buoyancy of deep water. Swimming keeps me sane. To me, it's an essential skill, just like walking. But many children and adults haven't acquired skills or comfort level in the water. The American College of Emergency Physicians cites drowning as the leading cause of unintentional death among children between 1 and 4 years of age. Here in Indiana, drownings comprised 26% of the 66 preventable child deaths that were reported in 2014, according to the Indiana Department of Child Services. Dr. Bob Ramos of Indiana University's School of Public Health tells me drowning is quick and it's silent, no matter what the age of the victim.
As far as the time frame, we're anywhere from 30 seconds and above. The act of drowning is not what people typically think. So, you know, we're kind of conditioned to see what we see on TV, this very dramatic event with lots of splashing and yelling for help. But actually, one of the things that comes into play during a drowning event is the drowning instinct, and it's actually a very quiet activity. The person becomes very vertical in the water, and because of panic, can actually not call or yell for help or wave for help. So if they're not a strong swimmer and they become in a vertical position, the actions they're taking to keep themselves up at all are going to wear them out just in, you know, in a matter of seconds. So then they slip under the water.
But drowning is preventable. I ask Ramos, who's also the director of IU's Aquatics Institute, how early a child can learn to swim. He makes a distinction between acclimating children to water and learning to swim.
Recent information from leading pediatricians are recommending that we acclimate children to the water as soon as possible. So really, as soon as they're ready and can be in the water. But a distinction here is we often talk about teaching kids to swim. And really around the age of 4, youth are at a cognitive level where they can actually learn the skills. Prior to 4, we're really talking, when we say teaching kids to swim before the age of 4, we're really talking about acclimating them to the water, getting them ready to work with an instructor, but during that time, always being with a parent or somebody that's supervised and able to hold them correctly in the water.
The Monroe County YMCA on any given Saturday morning is filled with sounds of children squealing, splashing, diving, and kicking. The only remotely silent activity here might be kids blowing bubbles. Aquatics Director Aaron Polosinski says when it comes to teaching kids to swim, making them feel safe in the water is a priority. And at the Y, preparing young children to swim is fun.
So we do things where we work on, splashing in the water. So we work on getting their faces wet, but pushing down against the water so they see and feel that resistance against the water, pulling at the water, blowing bubbles for sure, kicking their feet in the water, floating on both their stomachs and their backs. And we do all of that based in songs and games. We then, as they progress, will work on, submersion of their head and their face, going underwater, diving for toys on the ground based on their progression. And we teach the parents how to safely hold and support their children in the water as well. That's a big component of it, so the child feels safe.
Ramos adds his insights for working with very young children.
Always being held is crucial, so having that level of support when they're in the water, really keeping their head above water until probably around the age of 2 or 3. We do see some instances and some programs that encourage early dunking of children, but we see some things with early ear infections and problems with the eyes, and it is a fairly advanced skill. Infants do have some innate responses. For example, if you blow in an infant's face, they'll hold their breath. But it shouldn't be kind of taken as a sign that that's a skill that can be transferred to the water.
I asked both Ramos and Polosinski about a phrase I've heard, drown-proofing children. Is that even possible? Ramus responds with concern.
No, we do think it's a misnomer. There is no such thing, and we do find it dangerous for people to use the term because we think it can make people complacent. Really, there are water safety skills and things we do to be safe around the water, but we don't like to go to the point of calling anyone drown-proofed.
Polosinski agrees. She says it is impossible to ensure a child will never drown because there are too many variables we can't control. She cites fatigue as one example.
Little bodies tire out much more quickly than adult bodies. So we know of stories where parents have been right there next to their children and they turn away for just 5-10 seconds to engage with another adult, turn right back around, and their child is on the bottom of the pool because they've been playing in the pool, gotten so tired, and can't keep themselves afloat, even children that have participated in parent-child classes where we work on things like floating.
Polosinski says cold water is also a risk factor because it's a shock to the system and presents a risk of hypothermia.
A young child who may know how to float on their back, roll over and float on their back, which is what is the common drown-proofing swim techniques. That child is still then floating in cold water and hypothermia. It's a shock. The child may not know what to do, may immediately tense up.
Unfortunately, children on the autism spectrum are at a greater risk of drowning, Ramos confirms.
There's some information from the National Autism Association from some reports back in 2011. And when we look at instances to wander, which are common with people in the ASD spectrum, they had noted that about 91% of the total U.S. deaths reported in children somewhere within the spectrum under the age of 14 were related to drowning. So that is pretty high.
Ramus goes on to say the larger goal should be water safety, and learning to swim is just one aspect of that.
Water safety is the bigger message, which are the skills that teach us how to be safe in and around the water. And, of course, learning to swim is crucial, but it's a subcomponent. So really, that beginning method is just teaching people about how to be safe around the water, how to enter the water, how to exit the water. For example, knowing if you're talking about open water specifically, you know, we're talking about bodies of water where we have no idea what's beneath the water because obviously we don't have water clarity. So making sure that we know the slope of the entry, how quickly does it become deep, knowing if there's any debris or items in the water we may strike if we jump or enter the water too quickly. And some of this does take pre-planning, we try to have these conversations without sounding like we're trying to take all the fun out of it, obviously, and everyone knows being around and in the water can be a great deal of fun, but there are some precautionary steps you want to take to make sure that those outings, you know, end up being safe and enjoyable and don't end in some kind of tragic situation.
Indiana newspapers are riddled with tragic stories of people drowning in bodies of water large and small, from backyard pools to Lake Michigan. If someone doesn't know how to swim, simply wearing a life jacket can be, as Ramus says, a game changer.
The life jacket is absolutely crucial. I liken it a lot to bicycle helmets. When I was growing up, bicycle helmets weren't cool. And somehow the industry or the programs promoting them have made bike helmets cool. We see them in all different shapes and sizes and, you know, different iterations. And I feel if we could do the same for life jackets, it would be such a game changer. Because just having that life jacket on provides that extra layer of opportunity that if something were to happen, you'd have additional time for somebody to come and rescue you.
Here are four more tips to staying safe around water, courtesy of the American Red Cross. 1. Maintain supervision at all times. Remember, drowning only takes a few seconds. 2. Use the buddy system and never swim alone. 3. Be aware of weather conditions, waves, and rip currents. And 4. Don't overestimate your swimming ability. Everyone has limits. Ramus and Polosinski agree, with awareness and some training, swimming can be a lifelong skill that parents and kids can enjoy together. Reporting for WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
That was Assistant News Director Sarah Vaughn speaking with local water safety experts about water safety, drowning prevention, and learning to swim.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
If you see people walking around with vacant stares, oblivious to the world around them, watch out. If their arms are hanging down limply, it's probably okay, they're probably just zombies. But if they're holding a smartphone in front of their faces, they're playing Pokemon Go. This is a new kind of video game that takes the player outside and makes them go all over the place in the real world, in a kind of continuous treasure hunt. After only a week, Pokemon Go has exploded into having more users than Twitter. Nintendo, the game's creator, added $7 billion in stock value in just a few days. Millions of people are chasing Pokemons 24/7. By the way, Pokemon is a contraction of Pocket Monster. They're odd animated critters with names like Bulbasaurs, Mewtwos, Zubats, and Caterpies, which appear in all kinds of places but can only be seen on a smartphone screen. The game has been getting a lot of news coverage, and it's been causing a lot of problems, even for people who don't play. Now, if you're a player, your identity is at risk. A flaw in the program allowed it to track your location and access your total Google account, including your email, search history, and Google Drive documents. Nintendo says the flaw is being patched, so make sure you have the latest version of the app. And your money can be at risk. In O'Fallon, Missouri, four teenagers were busted for robbery. After they checked out the game, discovered some rather lonely places that were attracting players, and lay in wait for them. What's even more important, you may be at risk. There have already been people walking into traffic and getting run over, drivers crashing cars while playing the game, along with people falling in holes, at least one poisonous snake bite, and such a rash of broken bones, banged up feet, and ankle injuries that the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons has issued an urgent warning to players. Watch where you're going. Even if you don't play the game, you can suddenly find a crowd of people showing up in places where they really shouldn't be, including police stations, cemeteries, and private property. In Brazil, Indiana, last week, a crowd showed up at a guy's home, and he was so freaked out at all the strangers in his yard that he called the cops. In Portsmouth, England, dozens of people, including children, suddenly showed up at a sex shop. A gal in Wyoming looked under a bridge for a Pokemon and found a dead body. It's called augmented reality, having computer-generated images appear, or appear to appear, in the real world. It's great that video gamers are getting some outdoor exercise, but if you're playing, stay aware and watch where you're going. And if you're not playing, watch out for what's coming. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
Been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Kathy Norton and Taylor Haggerty, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
Our engineers today are Heather Perry and Rob Schoon. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Kelly Worley.
And I'm Janae Cummings. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. Recognized among the best newscasts in 2015 by the Indiana chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. Stay tuned for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.